Off the ball on News Talk.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.
Hello there, you're welcome along to the Sunday Papers. We're coming to you in podcast form and also we are streaming live on Facebook. Thanks very much for joining us. Have in studio Mick Foley from the Sunday Times and Kieran Cunningham from the Irish Daily Star. I'll get to your headlines first of all. So there's plenty of Dublin on the back pages. Sunday Times Sport, first of all. We have semi-detached, which maybe sums up how some people felt as the second half transpired yesterday in Croke Park. Dublin 124, Galway 212. Gavin Hale's men in the shadows, the strength of Dublin's squad is what Jim Gavin was talking about afterwards. And then on the right-hand side here, just an interesting short story, Duncan Castle's Chelsea. They bid 100 million for Jan Oblak, the Atletico keeper. They hit his 100 million euro release clause, but the 25-year-old decided to stay. That's an exclusive there in the Sunday Times. Next, we have The Observer. Premier League started yesterday. Liftoff, a winning start for Sarri as Pedro wraps up Chelsea victory at Huddersfield. And then they say an exclusive in The Observer. United's plan for director of football could deepen Mourinho's transfer ire. That's inside The Observer today. Sunday Independent then, going with Dublin as well. Jack McCaffrey, who was brilliant yesterday, number one. McCaffrey stars as history beckons for Gavin's brilliant dubs. And then beneath that, Guardiola not special but plans to build on winning culture. That's Jamie Jackson, Manchester City getting their campaign underway this afternoon. Mail on Sunday then. Nothing can stop the dubs. And that kind of is the feeling at the moment, isn't it? Galway give their best, but it's not enough against awesome champs. And then Mark O'Shea exclusive, which will come to... He's obviously their columnist. Fitzmaurice didn't need cheap shots from the likes of Pat Spillane. Kind of sums up his column. Next to The Sun, Jose in the Poghouse. This is pretty interesting. These comments came on Friday. I don't know where they were around yesterday. Maybe they just made it to the Sunday papers or maybe they're just being teased out a bit more this afternoon. But they're saying here, Paul Pogba blew his rift with Jose Mourinho wide open again. Essentially, he was asked about his happiness at Old Trafford and with Mourinho, and his reply was, there are things I cannot say, otherwise I will get fined. And then went on to talk about how brilliant the likes of Michael Carrick and Kieran McKenna and the coaches are, but not Jose Mourinho. And then Star Sunday, similar theme. It's Paul quiet, Pogba fears fine for any more talk, more being Mourinho. Again, that quote, there are things I can say and there are things I cannot say, otherwise I'll get fined. So again, Pogba, as he so often does, is on plenty of back pages and world-class boss Poch, so proud of the likes of Kane and Dele Alli back from World Cup. And then finally Sunday World, Jacks to the fore, Gavin's men see off tribe to keep quadruple dream alive. And so they're one game away from emulating Mick O'Dwyer's 78 to 81 Kerry Immortals, Roy Curtis says here. So they are your back pages. We might start, lads, with the football yesterday. I know you were both in at it. Mick, a few headlines neatly summed it up. The opening to your line summed it up as well. Another day in Croke Park yielded one more tarrowing win for Dublin and offered no reduction to the sense that this year's All-Ireland title has sat firmly in their laps since the start of May.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for reminding me. I actually forgot. When you're in the middle, as Kieran knows, you're in the middle of all that stuff. You kind of only have a half an idea what you're after writing yourself. Yeah, it was... Look, it was what it was, you know. I mean, I don't think there was any great quibbles over the result. It was interesting, actually, even just listening to people on the radio this morning and a bit last night, like, that, you know, there was this idea that Dublin weren't, you know, they weren't at their best and yet they cruised away. I thought they were, I thought in their own way, they were fairly awesome. Mm. Like, they don't play the way they used to 3 or 4 years ago, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. Like, they don't blow lads away. Mm. Malachy Clerkin was making his point various times yesterday. And it really resonated after yesterday. Yeah. The notion that, you know, pre-Donegal 2014, they just blow you away. Whereas now, they're like surgeons. They just prize you apart and they kind of very, very slowly, very gradually just wear you down. They did it in Omagh. They did it yesterday. You know, I'd say it must have been very demoralising for Galway because, like, Galway came, we expected Galway to be very, you know, to play defensively and for their system to really test Dublin.
Yeah.
But Dublin basically did to Galway what Galway wanted to do to Dublin.
Yeah.
They found I haven't seen a team all year find as much space in that Galway defence as Dublin did yesterday. Yeah. Whereas on the other side, Galway were being forced to do exactly what they would have wanted to force Dublin to do, which was kick from the flanks kind of get bottled up going down the middle. One high ball into Damien Comer, 5 minutes of a bit of a speed wobble, but that was about the height of it.
Yeah, but there's, like, there's a few things, Joe, that jumped out at me, just in the paper cover, Joe. Yeah. But, like, Joe has a few stats, you know, the you're handed out stats.
Is Joe now that famous that he doesn't even have a second name?
Mr. Brawley.
Don't give him that. QC. Don't give him that.
Joseph Brawley QC says, by halftime they posted 1-9 from 12 shots. Second half, 15 points from 19 shots. The first seven attacks brought 7 points. In the history of Gaelic football, I don't think there's been a team like that. Like, Mick wrote a great book about the last, you know, how the last great Kerry team came to crop of when they were going for the five in a row. And even that Kerry team, like, I'm young enough to watch those games, they still missed lots, you know, they still made mistakes. They're so clinic. Like, genuinely this year, I thought, there will come a time they'll miss Dermot Connolly and we'll be saying they need Dermot Connolly. And if they came up against Mayo of 2016, 2017, that might have been the case. But what's there now, they don't miss him at all. Yeah. And like, there's a few things that just, like Alan Brogan's headline, no, the headline Alan Brogan's piece, Gavin's men are not slaughtering teams, but know exactly what they're doing. And they won by 9 points, and there was a goal right at the end. It would have been 12 only for that. And in a way, we're looking at that as a kind of a tight enough battle for them. And that 9 points in any man's language is a hammering.
I think the ultimate line in Brogan's piece, actually, where is it here somewhere? He basically says that Dublin supporters would have liked to see the penalty go in. You know, you're in a bad situation, like when your own fans want a penalty to go in just so our crowd will get a test, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
That's pretty bad.
When Galway won a penalty, I think many Dublin supporters would have liked to see the Tribesmen rattle the back of the net and score a second goal. Yeah. I share that view, says Brogan. We haven't seen Dublin under severe pressure this summer, and if nothing else, sure, it would have been interesting to see how they'd react.
Sure, we would have passed the afternoon for us.
Somebody give us an hour for the cracks.
This is the semi-final.
Yeah. It would have been something to chat about up to half time. Yeah.
But the other thing,
to be fair though, I think we all had the same thought, didn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I think because you want to, like there's going to be a lot of, and we might come to this in a minute, the crowd, like why the crowd was down so significantly, and some people saying, I think partly the reason might be a lot of Dublin's games aren't competitive. And people are turned off by that. They've simply become, they've reached a level that other teams can't reach. They're winning so comfortably. But just to focus on individuals, Jack McCarthy yesterday, there was a few things about Jack. Like, his performance was out of this world. Mm. Like, there was the exuberance and the pace, and but the anticipation, defence, and driving forward, some of the balls he put forward. But there was a few other things. When he came off, when he was substituted 3 minutes ago, he had this big smile on his face. When he was interviewed afterwards out in the, on RT, one of the first words he used was fun, how much fun he'd had. And he said, we're in a good place. Like, was this? Yeah. And he had a big smile. And it brought you back. Remember his
Sunday game?
Yeah, the banquet. And he'd done his cruciate that day, 4 minutes into that game. And he was, you know, he was the life and soul of the party. But a lot of people don't realise that All-Ireland finally was a couple of weeks into his final year as a medical student at UCD. He qualified as a doctor in June. Can you imagine the pressure of a final year medical, while you're trying to rehab a cruciate, which is notoriously difficult to do, and then to reach that level of performance? That's one individual. What he's put himself through in the last year, it's remarkable.
He's extraordinary. I think he just has a great sense of perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah.
I think he sees life as a bit of a game, actually.
Yeah.
As you get to know him.
But you kind of get this all the time. I mean, you know, these teams that win multiple All-Irelands and that, people only see, that's the most visible part of the iceberg, like, is the four All-Ireland medals or whatever, but the amount of stuff that these guys have gone through, or even in their own careers, kind of different challenges they would have had, like, but, you know, it's not all just about rocking up and winning, you know, knocking the ball around and winning All-Ireland, but like McCaffrey, there's just such a joy about the way he plays. There was a moment there yesterday where he was just, he took off from a standing start with the ball in hand. He just blew past the fella. And he just made you smile. It was like a child about 8 years of age deciding, I'm going to run really fast now for five seconds and see how far I can go.
And to off see that after a cruciate, like and for Donegal, so I'm looking at that, like what's happened Patrick McBurney, and thinking, okay, Patrick might get his pace back exactly where he was. McCarthy doesn't seem to have lost anything.
Dennis Walsh had a really class summation of just the situation. He just said at one point, it's hard to know anymore how good Dublin are. In most of their games, the only contest is against themselves and the empirical standards against which they measure their performances. They looked good, but who knows what will be said in the review meeting when they convene in their bunker in DCU. There might be blood in the walls. It is hard when you're watching to actually put yesterday's performance into any kind of context now. Was it better than the Mayo games?
The problem, I suppose, one of the things that's happened this year, it's not so much the teams have gone back, but the teams that are coming at them now are at a different stage of development.
Yeah.
We'll say to Mayo last year, for example. So Galway have come forward, but they're still a bit back. Tyrone have come forward.
Like Mayo with 6 years behind them, gradual progression last year.
I am fully of the belief, and I have been for a couple of years now, that if you want to beat Dublin, if you're Tyrone or if you're whoever, right? You have to, actually you have to go back to the Kerry Offaly kind of template, if you like, and that is you focus your entire year on one game, and that's Dublin.
Is that what Offaly did?
You focus your league, you focus your provincial championship, you focus all your training, you focus the kind of personnel you're developing, and you say to yourself, well, if I can develop a team that can beat Dublin, we should be able to beat most everybody else. We mightn't do it with all the aplomb that we might have done before, but we're going to treat this as we're going for Dublin.
I want to throw a few things
you see
about
that truth
on
it, just very quickly, because the only defeat was against Donegal in 2014, and in Rory Kavanagh's book in particular, I think, he points out that Jim McGuinness had been working on that plan for 2 years on how to beat them. And even when you go back to that game, though, 25 minutes in, Dublin were 8-3 ahead and Connolly had a great goal chance. There would have been 8 up and the game was over, despite all the planning. Yeah.
But
so
you
that
have to take the gamble.
Shows how hard it is to beat them.
You have to take the gamble at this stage.
To remind you of another quote from your piece yesterday. It's interesting you talk about where Galway were, because I want to get your thoughts on what Galway threw up yesterday, what they produced. Kevin Walsh said that they're very much in a learning curve. He said, playing in headquarters with the red carpet under your feet, when you're not used to the little things that go through your head, you have to get used to Croke Park. Maybe the goalposts are moving a small bit. That's probably why we had double the amount of wides and drop shorts that Dublin had. And like Joe Brolly's sense is, come back Mayo, all is forgiven. And he's like, you know, oh look, this has been a theme of his all year, but he says somebody forgot to tell Galway there was a semi-final on. Sean Kavanagh said on RTÉ Radio beforehand that he totally believed Galway will put it up to them. Like that was going to happen, says Joe. Al Sugary nonsense is his verdict on Kavanagh. And he said, nothing begets nothing, he says, of Galway's performance. I thought of the difference had it been Mayo playing yesterday and not this dull, robotic outfit. Is that harsh in Galway, too harsh in Galway, or is there a nub of a fair point there?
There's context in all of these things. Like, I mean, Mayo had a good few runs at Dublin over that period of time, so they figured out what works. And one of the things that works with Dublin, and that they got it really right in the last couple of finals, was they got up in their grill when Dublin came forward in a way that Galway didn't yesterday. Galway were kind of a bit more, you know, hold our shape, shuffle back, shuffle across, which they've been doing all year. Mayo, because of their tackling technique, because of the years of seasoning behind them, because of the pace they played the game at, after years of playing at that level, were able to go out and disrupt Dublin offence when Dublin came forward, you know. Galway are in a situation, Galway have made huge progress this year, but they came up against, do you know what it reminds me of? I was thinking about it this morning. It reminded me, kind of trying to figure out what were Galway like, of going to matches years ago, you know, with your old fella, right? And you're driving home, we drive home the car, and you'd be kind of, you could be 40 minutes, 50 minutes, analysing what the hell happened there, why did they win, why did they lose? And at the end of the day, he often used to say to me, do you know what? They just weren't able. And that's the end of it. And that's the thing with Galway yesterday. They just weren't able, mentally, physically, tactically, everything. And it's not that they won't be able next year. It's just that right now, they came up against a crowd that are so far ahead in terms of time, in terms of experience, in terms of everything. And Galway will be better for it. Like, it'll be interesting to see how they go at it next year. I'd say they'll pull back a bit on the league, I'd say, and they'll just, again, like I was saying, they'll probably focus on how do we handle the Dublin.
Because I thought afterwards Kevin Walsh did say something which was particularly interesting for a post-match press conference, far more interesting than what you normally get.
Right.
And then he talked about, like, they were promoted last year. Like, this was the year back in Division 1. They got to the final unbeaten and then ran Dublin fairly close on that, then won Connacht and beat 3 Division 1 teams in the Championship. So they had so many big games this year they had to get up for. And it was just basically, I think it was a bridge too far. And even the week-on-week thing, they're coming back from Monaghan, like people had their different theories about their attitude again in that game in Salt Hill. But no matter what their attitude was, they had a week to get ready then for Dublin. And it's just, it was just too much.
It's not enough.
It's funny because there was 2 announced changes to the Dublin team before the game. John Small and Owen Merchant starting. And they were for man-marking jobs on Shane Walsh and Ian Burke. And Walsh and Burke probably had the better of the two battles,
They did fine.
The Galway can take a lot out of this year, but they have to build on it, you know. And they have to tweak their plan. They do need to get the change the balance between defence and attack. You know, the like to.
But that's
on the surface.
That's
you can say they put up
2-12,
but the game, the goal at the end was, you know, it was in dead time.
Yeah.
But like Andy Moran said a few months ago, that you need to score at least 20 points in a big game in Croke Park to beat Dublin. Yesterday, you would have needed to score what would you need to score? 28, 29?
28.
Yeah. So like, that's the challenge.
But I mean, I suppose the flip there is that if Galway had been able to impose more pressure, they wouldn't have got to the 124. Yeah, yeah. But the point remains
the
same. They will, yeah.
Dublin will always get around 20 points. So that's a massive challenge for any team to hit that against.
But I mean, the kind of pointing for Mayo thing comes back to that point that just, we'd say Galway now are the coming team, like, and the word, you know, they're a coming team, they're emerging, and Tyrone are emerging. We just have to, it's going to balance out again in time, like, you know. I mean, we are in a sort of a Kerry 78, 81 situation.
Yeah. I think Donegal are as well. When Donegal get the likes of McBrearty or McHugh, sure, back, they will. And Kerry, for all the doom and gloom, if they get, particularly if they get Donny Buckley and his coach and a decent manager, the Kerry have a huge amount of raw material to work with.
Let's talk Kerry, because there's a few pieces on Kerry. And just by the way, if you're wondering what Jim Gavin was saying, Shane McGrath has his quotes in the mail here. And it's the usual stuff, really. He's talking about how great it is to work with such a group of determined men, makes it so easy. We're on their coattails, he says. They drive the agenda. Motivation comes from them. Selfless with their time and their energy, and they've great support from family and work colleagues, and we're just helping to be the best they can be. And
just a quick one, what did you make of the crowd before we move on? Because there's so much talk. Like, it was the smallest crowd for Dublin semi-finals since 95.
Yes.
It was just over 54,000.
Yeah.
Every other semi-final under Jim Gavin, there was at least 80,000. The crowd was virtually identical to the Clare Galway hurling semi-final, which at the same time, 5 p.m. on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Is there a bit of apathy creeping in? Like, there are various reasons you could put forward. It is a peak holiday time, like it's a builder's holiday, for example. It's coming up to people back to school time. A lot of people take their holidays around now. Also, there's a cost factor, and there are extra games on the calendar.
God, we have an All-Ireland final next week.
Yeah, but I wonder, because I remember the last All-Ireland Kilkenny one, when they were doing the Lap of Honour at the end, a lot of their fans had left before the Lap of Honour was finished. Yeah. Like, is there a sense of being taken for granted in any way, do you think?
I think all the things you hit on are...
Yeah, yeah.
Perfectly fair and legitimate, and can account for about 15,000-20,000 people not showing up for
sure.
I mean, of course, it's different. I mean, you think of Cluxton and that free against Kerry and the euphoria.
Absolutely.
With each passing year, it's become a bit different. Like, thankfully, the finals have been so unbelievable against Mayo that even just the sheer thrill of beating them by a point and after a replay and everything meant there was euphoria. But of course, it's different. Like, we've Alan Brogan in a semi-final wishing Galway had scored that penalty.
We're in a situation that we haven't known in Gaelic games for 40 years. Yeah. I mean, you can equate it a bit to the Kilkenny hurlers 10 years ago. Yeah. I actually do think Dublin are kind of in a Kilkenny 07, 08 kind of state of mind now. Dublin are the same state of mind that Kilkenny were that time.
Yeah.
You'd wonder what the final will be like, because, I mean, it is a nagging thing with them to absolutely nail a final, nail their final performance. And if Dublin nailed their final performance against someone...
I think, I felt a long way back that this had the potential to be their easiest All-Ireland.
Mm.
Unfair to call any of them easy, but even, I remember at the start of the year looking around and we had Billy Joe Padden on and I said, I kind of feel they're 6, 7, 8 points better than anyone at least.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was like, this could be the one that they trot home.
It's goals. Yeah. If you can score goals against them. Like, that was the excitement yesterday, was when Comer got a goal, then they had a chance at the penalty. Yeah. If you get a couple of goals... I always thought Galway were going to have to score at least 3 goals to win this game.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got 2, but as you say, one was in garbage time.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they lost by 12 points, or they beat Tyrone by 12 points last year. Only for that goal, it would have been the same yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what we're talking about.
Like, I don't think there's a wider issue, and in a few years' time, if it's Dublin against Mayo in a semi-final and no one can call it, we'll have 80,000 and unbelievable... search for tickets. And of course, like, Galway do have an All-Ireland final next week. I think all the factors you mentioned.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But there's another factor that should be worrying for the rest, though, if you do want more competitive championships. As you look at the age profile, bar Stephen Cluxton and a couple of the others, most of them are 3 or 4 years, if not more, off their peak.
Mm.
Like, the likes of Brian Fenton, Conor Callaghan, Brian Harrow, etc., they're going to get a lot better.
Yeah.
Far better than
that. But I think we're all in agreement, or correct me if I'm wrong, that it's still brilliant because the type of football they play, the standards they're setting.
Like, they're a brilliant brand leader for the thing.
Like, conversion rate is now in the high 60s, which is unprecedented for shot conversion. Like, if you're going to have dominance, you want them to be dominated.
That's what you want. That's how you want football to be played.
Yeah. It's like Spain. I keep going back to Spain 2010, 2012. Some people were saying they're boring because they were just on a different level.
Yeah.
That wasn't boring. It was just an incredible team that nobody else could get near.
Yeah.
So, and Dublin are in that plane now, I think.
And it's equally boring. Kind of, it's just up to the other teams to come up to the level, but that's what it is, and it'll make them a hell of a lot better for it, you know?
Yeah. Podcast listeners will know if it's Monaghan or Tyrone in the final at this stage. We don't know, regardless of who it is. What are we talking? 5, 6, 7 point win in the final?
I'd say at least.
Probably, yeah.
All things being right.
All things being right, yeah. I mean, what will be an issue come the time is whoever it is, they're going to be rookies in all Ireland final. Yeah. Whereas Dublin have obviously done it all. You're talking about the red carpet under your feet, like, you know, Tyrone and Manon are going to be.
These lads live in red carpet.
They do. They have them in their houses and everything.
Other GAA stuff. So we mentioned Kerry. You've got Paul Galvin's piece in front of you there making the Sunday Times. So he's talking about he touches on the hate mail issue, which is run this week. And then he has a pretty interesting point about the club scene in Kerry, which I hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, he's kind of making the point, and I suppose he's looking at the nearest urban area to him. He's from Fenuig in North Kerry, so the nearest big town to him is Tralee. It's 22,000 people in the urban area of Tralee. He's just saying there's just basically too many clubs in the area for such a small area, so that's diluting their ability to produce players, and it's affecting the competitiveness, I suppose, of the championship overall. So it's an interesting one. It is an interesting one. It's kind of like there's a lot of bits and pieces in Kerry that they need to consider, and that is one of them. Like, we would have always looked down the years at the club game in Kerry and said the one thing that the Kerry footballers get is loads of games.
That was a complaint under Fitzmaurice, wasn't it, that they hadn't played any club football?
Well, there was issues around guys getting free to play club matches, that's for sure, yeah. But just on the wider point that he's making about the club game, like, I mean, if you're playing club football in Kerry, you get tons of matches.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, whether they're nearly playing too many matches is nearly more the issue down there, I think, than anything. But yeah, like, I mean, I suppose Paul is looking at it from the point of view of developing elite footballers, you know. Mm. And if you have, you know, too many clubs servicing a small area, that's obviously going to dilute the quality of the player you're producing. And he makes the same point for his own club, Fenuig. Fenuig would have also been Jimmy Dean in country back the years, and obviously himself.
He says they're in the midst of this decade's existential crisis. Every 10 years or so, all the looking backwards catches up on it.
Yeah.
Us, you could call it legacy thinking. Interesting point on, like, the captaincy he mentions. Like, they still have the old traditional captaincy situation. Well, so their captain this year was Shane Murphy, the goalkeeper on the bench. And then his clubmate is therefore steps in his place. So it's Gavin White and he's captain. And he says between them, in their debut seasons, they have 8 championship starts between them. This practice is no help to a manager and has to change quickly.
No, that's utter nonsense. Because you do look at the impact, you know, that Cluxton makes as captain with Dublin, and Michael Murphy at Donegal, Killian O'Connor the last few years of Mayo. I don't know how they sustain that. Like, I think the club thing can be overstated. Like, there's a fair few counties over the years that have been very competitive inter-county level. I mean, like Donegal, I know very well. Donegal club football is very poor. Like, no Donegal club's ever won the Ulster Club Championship, for example.
Yeah.
You don't need it. And, like, there's a bit too much of putting on the poor mouth in this to me, to be honest. Like, they have won 4 minor titles. They have put in David Clifford in his first year, who's been in Footballer of the Year form, if you look at his stats.
Yeah. Mm.
Sean O'Shea, Gavin White, Tom O'Sullivan. Like, new fellas have come in that look really good, and there's more to come.
Yeah.
So like, if you're looking outside of Dublin, if you're going to be a manager, so you can take any county at the moment, you would grab it, you would jump at the Kerry job.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most attractive job out there.
It's the most attractive job, it's also the hardest job, but I mean, for all good reasons.
Turn O'Brien answered you on this on Twitter, try managing in Division 4.
And I thought about that before I put it up. I put up that the Kerry job was the hardest job in, did I say Irish Sport or Gaelic Games? I can't remember.
Let's say Irish Sport. Let's go all out.
I thought you said European Sport, to be honest.
European Sport, you know what?
World Sport.
Let's do it. No, but like, the point is, like, if Carlo go well, for example, this year, I mean, there wasn't any expectation or pressure on Carlo to win a game, you know? And they were fantastic, and they did it, and, you know, for all, and they did a fantastic job. This crowd, like, you know, it's an All-Ireland or nothing. And that, in the modern era, is ludicrous for Kerry. I think, I mean, without wanting to kind of dwell on the whole thing, I mean, I think there's been a huge overrating of the players that Kerry have at their disposal. Mm. The guys coming through, you're absolutely right, you're very good. But the guys that they have been dealing with for the last 4 or 5 years, so he did very, very well. Like, yeah. I mean, there's that aspect of it. I think as well, going back to Paul's point about the existential crisis, he's right. I mean, Kerry, to me, for everything they've won, they have been a reactive county for pretty much about a century now. They react to stuff.
Yeah.
They reacted to Down in the 60s, right? They reacted to Dublin getting really fit in the 70s, brought up to another level, you know? They reacted to, I suppose they reacted to Cork in a way in the 90s. And they reacted to Tyrone. They react, you know?
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff. They're reacting to Dublin now.
Not quite the innovators.
The only time they were ever innovators was when Dick Fitzgerald wrote a book in 1920-something about...
1914, he was there.
Was it 1914? Yeah, yeah. Like, with, you know, kind of the positional grid and you stay in your square and you kick the ball away if it comes near you.
Yeah.
It was revolutionary at the time. But it was at least the first time a training manual really had been put together. But since that, because they've had so much success, they can be comfortable enough to say, well, what we're doing is right and we shouldn't change it. And it's still happening now.
And you see that even with the last All-Ireland that won, that they won. They won it by copying the team they were playing in the final. Like the Mirror done in the final. Like they react to what's out there. And as you say, it's a very good point. But you know, the pressure thing I do find interesting. It's obviously a hugely pressurised job. But I look at somebody like Andy McEntee, who came into a county that was used to being having huge success under Sean Boylan at a low ebb. And the pressure, like we saw the pressure when they lost to Tyrone, how he reacted with the referee and in his interviews. Like there's pressure in a lot of managers. Like it's not a, I don't know if there's more in Kerry, to be honest.
Maybe it's apples and oranges a little bit. Yeah. It's the pressure that's in Kerry is just a constant thing to silverware. You know?
Well, Mark O'Shea, to pick up on the theme in the Mail on Sunday, says, Mick O'Dwyer's punchline that Kerry were always at a disadvantage because they have to play against 31 and a half counties is funny because it's true. So that's his sense. He's very unhappy at the treatment Fitzmaurice is getting, basically. He talks about the ugly underbelly that the fallout revealed, talks about the hate mail. He wondered maybe should Fitzmaurice have said anything because you're giving fools their moment in the sun, and he paints a picture of one of these fools turning to his wife and saying, I wrote one of those letters, and he hopes that the wife turned around and called him pathetic. But he says, I don't perceive his reign to be error-strewn or the disaster which others, notably Pat Splann, perceived it to be. He says, Pat came out with the cheap line that Kerry's game plan under Fitzmaurice was like Theresa May's Brexit strategy in that one did not exist. And then he says, seriously, I sat through Eamon's video sessions when he was a selector under Jack O'Connor, and the detail both frightened and illuminated. To suggest that he did not have a game plan is nonsense. The principles never change. You had to earn the right to play ball, and when you did, it was moved quickly to the inside forwards. He says, Splann also suggested that we had no kick-out strategy. Utter nonsense. We always did. Fitzmaurice had as much success, perhaps more than any other, on putting pressure on Stephen Cluxton and innovatively made us press up after set plays to save lungs and legs with some effect in 2016. It was quite memorable, that game, actually, that they did that. And he says, on our own kickouts, there was always a strategy. The problem is that we didn't possess the quality to execute it. I must say, I did watch Spillane give this no game plan line. And it was just patently not true.
It's
like,
not
it was
correct.
Madness that he was getting away with saying this on TV. He should have been challenged more in the studio, I felt. Like, Fitzmaurice clearly was a game plan type manager. He had different game plans for different games.
Like
the kick-out strategy, that Dublin game that O'Shea references, the 2016 semi-final. Like, again, remember Cluxton, five in a row.
That's happened a few times. They did that a few times to Dublin over the years.
There's no team at that level going out without a game plan, without going out without three or four different game plans.
I'm delighted someone like O'Shea has actually just pierced that nonsense for what it was, because he was trying to spout it again yesterday, and it was just it's just not true.
No.
Yeah. Like, it's funny, I can't name, but I know one individual who started a league game this year. But he was substituted really early in the game because he didn't follow the game plan. Yeah. That's an important game plan. This was a
For
Division
Kerry.
One team. No, I'm not going to go into it.
Okay, fair enough.
But that's an important game plan. Now, managers see if you're not doing what you're told, you're going to be hooked. Yeah.
The notion that he won an All-Ireland with a game plan.
This comes back to what I was saying before about the quality of the player. I mean, he won an All-Ireland in 2014. That was a real manager-led All-Ireland, I think, in a lot of ways, right? And you know, I mean, it was more the games, I think, against Dublin that probably maybe rattled him a little bit, maybe shook his trust in both the game plan and the players he had at his disposal, and it all kind of comes together. But, I mean, to say, no game plan. Where are you even going with that?
I don't know.
You know, God bless him. Where are you going with
that? That's easy criticism to throw out, and then you don't have to do real analysis.
The hate mail, as it's been billed, thing is, it's interesting because it's just a reflection of the way the world we live in. Like, you get it in social media. Like, the most innocuous comment, as you do when you're watching a game, you make the odd observation, just throw it on Twitter. And it's something innocent yesterday, I love watching Ian Burke. Like, he's a class act. And a few hours later, Aidan O'Shea.
Controversial.
But Aidan O'Shea replied, he's a great player to watch. Somebody you'd love to play alongside, I guess. And somebody replied to him with a homophobic slur.
Wow.
There's that kind of permanent anger there. And you're going,
sorry, I say why as if I'm shocked. Yeah.
Aidan O'Shea, I was just thinking, how often does Aidan O'Shea get that kind of crap?
It's
over nothing. And then, actual physical letters. I don't know if you got many over the years, Michael, but I got a few. But most of them were kind of innocent enough. They just said, you clown, you know nothing about Mourinho or rugby or Dublin GA or whatever. Mm. But you do, I got one 20 years ago. I'd written something about sport in the North. But it just two lines, it said, keep out of politics, stick to the sport. And it had a photograph of a guy in a balaclava with a machine gun. So I went to a friend at the garden and said, should I do anything with that? And he said, I said, just leave it. Like, if you hear from me again, like, come back to me. But you know, those are the things that make you, you know, that go to an extreme. Most of it, you just brush it off as cracks, yeah. I think, mm-hmm. you know.
It's just, it's always been there, you know. It's always been there. I mean, in the Kerry context, it's been there forever. Like, I mean, he was right to bring it up, I think. I think he was right to bring it up, and it's good that it's kind of been aired a little bit. But I mean, you know,
it's not something we can do anything about.
No, you can do about it. What strikes me actually about it is, in an era when you have so many kind of routes to abuse somebody, I suppose, between yeah. social media and everything else. I mean, to sit down, take the trouble to get out a piece of paper, get your green biro, write your mail, get a stamp from your carer or whatever, yeah. get permission to go to the post office and send it. Like, there's a lot of thought goes into that.
The worst thing I find about the letters is that they have your address.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
the part that just makes you think,
yeah.
You know, you don't information being out there.
No, that's terrible. It just reminds me of what I was sent to you outside. I think peak hate mail, like, really, you know, you're striking a chord if you get hate mail, like Pat Spillane did many, many years ago, that was just addressed Pat Bollocks, Kerry.
Yeah, and it arrived, yeah.
And the postman knew where to take it. Like.
Funny, Mark O'Shea on the hate mail thing remembers Paddy getting hate mail and how he would try and he'd get everybody around the kitchen table. He said, come here and look at what this Amadon is after writing. And he said he'd have a big belly laugh about it. Now he says, it looked like it was water off a duck's back, although Mark says maybe it wasn't, but he was determined not to let anyone know that he wouldn't be cowed by rough language.
Yeah, I mean, but he did bring up in that interview with Kevin Kimmage in the Sunday Indo, that quote that's been, you know, has been recycled so much this week, you know, the roughest type of effing animals you could meet.
Yeah.
You know, and that you know, so it did get to him at some level, I think, when you consider that line.
And if you go back even a few years before that, he used to do the odd interview back in the late 90s. And I remember Vinnie Murphy was below there, and there was talk of Vinnie playing for Kerry. And he was talking one time about Vinnie playing, and the interviewer, he picked up the tape recording and said, can we do this interview with this off, like, you know? And he said, no, not really though. So turn it on again. What do you think of Vinny? Well, you know, Vinny's one of a lot of players we're looking at. But what he was saying to him off the record was, like, you've no idea what people are like down here. You have no idea what they're saying about me, about the decisions I'm trying to, about the team, the decisions I have to make, about Vinnie Murphy, about everything.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, it is, like, my wife is from Dingle. I spent a lot of time in Kerry. I know it's the nature of my job, I suppose, as well, that football will come up. But I mean, literally, like, I mean, the football comes straight into the conversation.
And the problem with that is,
so quickly,
more so than, say, Premier League, where at least there's a weekly diet, more than a weekly diet, there are so few games at inter-county level.
A lot of
there's
time
so
to
much
brood
talking
over
time.
Yeah.
Even the smallest thing, there's weeks of debate and stuff.
Yeah, and a sense of entitlement is a problem. Like, if you do have this assumption that you should win the All-Ireland every 2 years out of every three,
yeah.
and you see that in other countries, like, say, Tipperary, you see it as well. It's a toxic thing. Like,
makes it very volatile,
and it's completely unrealistic in the modern world to have that kind of expectation, I think.
Someone made the point during the week, just some guy in Twitter made the point that it was just, what was most disgraceful about it was that Kerry had been edged out by two ordinary teams like Galway and Monaghan. Mm.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's nothing ordinary about Galway. In fact, Monaghan are extraordinary, you know? But look, that's what you're
Shane McGrath had a good point as well in his piece where he was just saying we can put this down to social media. But he's like, I mean, mainstream media has always played its part as well. And he said
absolutely.
Some of the stuff that the likes of
what
Brody
pundits say, what newspaper columnists write.
Absolutely.
Sets the tone.
There's an exclusive in the Sunday World, or they say it's an exclusive. So Katie Taylor, pages 2 and 3 of the Sunday World. Effectively, there's a new documentary, Katie, coming out in cinemas in October. Ross Whittaker involved. He did the Saviours documentary. And
when Ali came to Ireland as well.
And do you know, did a brilliant little documentary on surfing last year.
Yeah,
down in the West
he did
Coast
on the Hinch.
Beautifully shot. It was just gorgeous. So there are some quotes from the documentary. I know you were saying she was doing some interviews yesterday.
Yeah, and there's some quotes from that yesterday. I think Donald Clark, in the Irish Times film critic, interviewed her as well, from what I saw a tweet. And like, Esther is a film critic, and she has a few quotes from yesterday and then a few from the film. And like, Ross will be a friend of mine, and like, I've declared an interest in one of the talking heads in the documentary. So I actually haven't seen it. I'm really looking forward to it. But I went to a few of Katie's fights and went for a few pints with Ross, and some of the stuff he told me about, it will open people's eyes to aspects of her they've never seen before. Like, they would have heard her maybe talking about her faith or other people reference her, but like, he has shots. He's got incredible access, like before fights, in the hotel room with her mother, both of them praying before fights, and Katie bawling her eyes out. Like, she gets so emotional and overwhelmed by it. Like, it's, and stuff about her training routine. like, I guarantee when you see it, nobody in Irish sport trains harder. Like, not the rowers, no rugby player, no athlete. Like, it's savage stuff. And it, because there is a bit of, I find at times a bit of revisionism with Katie, or not revisionism, but people are reluctant to give her credit. Like, they keep saying stuff that there's not the depth in boxing. And or that some of her opponents have full-time jobs. Well, the reality in pro boxing, in male pro boxing as well, loads of the fighters, the majority of them aren't full-time. They have other jobs on the side. There were four world champions with belts, reigning world champions with belts. She's beaten two of them. She's taken two of the belts. She wants to fight the others, and she will in time. And she's not ducking any fights. Like, it's, I think she's a remarkable person, and I think she's been the biggest game changer ever in Irish sport. Like, literally has changed the sport, because it wouldn't even be an Olympic sport without her. Mm. One thing I find interesting, I've asked her about this before, is she a feminist? And she's really reluctant to say she is. And to me, she's the ultimate feminist, like, in terms of the fight for equality and how she's got what women's boxing to the level it's at.
Why do you think she's reluctant to?
I don't know,
just doesn't want to go down.
I think some people see that as for some reason they think there's a stigma to that label. Yeah. I think some people think that way. I don't think there is in the slightest, but she seems reluctant.
I think feminism has a stigma.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, you're going to get in trouble now for saying that.
No, I think it is. It can be unfairly so.
Yeah.
But I think it is. I think it is dismissed as angry, hateful terrain.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if you look at what feminism is at its
core, there's a cartoonish version of it. That people have a particular
angry mob, burn your brands, that kind of, you know, all the cliches. So I think it does have a stigma.
Okay, but in this piece now, it's interesting. She does mention. Because she hasn't talked about Pete and the split with Pete. Mm. And there's quotes in the film, the first time she had to go training without him, she's driving in by herself and the tears were rolling down her face. I just felt like every time I was stepping into the ring without my dad at that time, I was missing an arm. Mm. Mm-hmm. And that is stark, because the bond was so strong.
Yeah, they have that quote, actually. I'll just hold it up in the camera. That's the big quote they kind of lead with. That's the strapline headline.
Yeah.
The missing an arm line without her dad. And her brother in the documentary talks about, they found out about the issues, I suppose. You almost feel like it's too private to even talk about.
That's actually what's often struck me about that.
They found out before the Olympics that there was marital issues, and then, you know, that.
But that's one of the extraordinary things about this documentary, because it does document the year or the 2 years since Rio, when she was, like, I was in the mix zone in Rio when she was beaten and she comes out. And it's one of those times you go, I don't really like the job. I don't want to be here. You want to leave her alone. She was so upset. And even some of the stuff she was saying, you know, it's been such a tough year. Mm. And you know, she wasn't just talking about the boxing defeats. Mm. There was more. And you're going, no, this is, you know, just leave her alone.
It's too close. You know, it's too.
I know that's the job you have to ask and you have to be there. But you just saw somebody was in real pain there.
It must have been so raw at that time.
I think it's particularly, we say, for like yourself, no, Kieran. I mean, I sat down, which is 10 years ago now, since I sat down with Katie. But I can still, I mean, it's one of those interviews that kind of sticks in your head. Like, when you get even slightly close to the work that she's doing, and kind of, you know what, you can see in her face, in the way she's talking, when you know the work she's doing behind the scenes, as you said there, like, you can't but wish the best for her. So when things kind of go wrong, and particularly profoundly life-changing things go wrong, it's just, as you say, it feels almost intrusive, like, even have to go there.
This documentary will do well, won't it?
It's getting a full cinema release, which is really unusual for a documentary.
See, I think everybody in Irish society knows Katie, respects
her
hugely,
they do anyway.
And actually will want
but
to
it's
get
it. It's funny, this is an argument
better.
I often have like with the desk. Like, people will say, you know, like, I might, because I've gone to a few of the fights, I might say, there's another fight coming up, I'd like to go to this. And they say, nobody cares. But nobody cares about women's boxing or whatever. And I said, well, even if they don't care about women's boxing, they're really interested in Katie Taylor. I think there is a distinction.
Yeah. Oh,
like, I think she has this status in Irish sport and Irish life that, like, most people can't mention any other woman boxers, but they're very interested in what she does.
Well, non-UFC fans still are interested in Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
And for very different reasons. Yeah. Non-women's boxing fans are very interested in Katie. So
I mean, she's apart from her sport. She's a brand, in inverted commas, apart from her sport. But she's more than that. Like, I mean, she's a person of very serious substance. I mean, whether you're a religious person or not, I mean, she's all about conviction. I think that's what I like about her anyway, is that conviction in her beliefs, whether it's her conviction in the belief that she can be the best in the world, even if they're, you know, even if the sport is considered not to be, the opponents aren't, she just goes at it as though they're the greatest fighters in the world.
What's interesting as well is she's an incredibly private person, living a very public life. Yeah. And there is that, she finds that very difficult. She makes no secret of it. But when you, the more you get to know her and talk to her, she's got this kind of dry, subtle sense of humour. Like, she's quite, she can be quite funny and she can be good company, but she just, she has to put herself out there and sell herself in the pro game, and she hates that. She finds that like very, very hard. Yeah. And particularly, like the last fight, and she was asked on the eve of it, she was asked about Pete being shot. And she had to kind of answer, you know, and it's just, like, this, the more stuff had happened, you know, obviously, and it's been very, very difficult for her. But, like, she's, from what I gather, she's really happy with the documentary. And there's an interesting line in that piece. She approached Ross to do it. She wanted this out there. She wanted a document of herself rather than a book. Like, I know she did a kind of a book after the Olympics, or her Olympic story with Johnny Watterson. But I think she was a big fan of Saviors. Did you see Saviors? Saviors was outstanding.
Yeah, brilliant.
Outstanding. So,
and she says she's watched that a few times, so she was familiar with Ross's work. And I guess you put your documentary up there. I mean, it's a bit like the Players' Tribune and all these kind of different outlets now. That there's no misinterpretation there. This is just it, like, straight to the viewers. And there must be an appeal in that when so much of your life is through newspapers and quotes and headlines.
Well, there isn't. I mean, there's an editing process as well that goes through when you're doing a documentary. But, I, you know, if you're working filmmaker. In tandem with the filmmaker, then it's a different story.
Okay. That's in October, so I guess we'll be talking about that again.
It's beforehand. It's in the, there's a documentary film festival in the IFC or IFI, whatever it's called now, in September. And it's on. There's a showing there beforehand in Dublin.
Okay. I presume you've been gripped by the golf. The USPGA is on golf's fourth major, a sport desperate to try and claw back some of the
love. Yeah, we were talking about this, and I think it just shows you, because just going from boxing, like, one of the reasons boxing went from 20 million regular viewerships on a Saturday night to disappearing from most people's consciousness was because the way it disappeared off television and went pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And I genuinely think a lot of people didn't realise the PGA was on because it's gone to this obscure website.
11 Sports, yeah. Whose production values, I have to say, are lacking.
They're not up to your standards, Joe.
I mean, they're taking the US feed, which in itself is okay. I mean, you get Nick Faldo and various good people in that. But then they cut back occasionally to the presenter, and Jamie Donaldson is in what can only be described as a radio studio come bunker.
And not like this now, Joe.
I mean, this is honestly, no bunker. I was texting Nathan Murphy last night saying, we, like, they should have used our studio. Like, this looks like 5-star compared to that. No, they're just, it's basically a set camera in the corner.
Right.
A bit like where you put a camera set in a car on the dashboard to just video. So it's one camera in studio looking down on the two of them. And they're in a studio which is just kind of a radio studio. Nothing on the walls except for some kind of cardboard 11 Sports logos, which have been, I would presume, blue tacked onto the walls behind them.
Right.
It's kind of like Alan Partridge meets 11 Sports. So it's real. I mean, it's terrible, but if you want to watch it.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds fantastic.
David Walsh says, live on your laptop tonight, golf fans. Broadcast newcomers target young viewers with affordable alternative to rival fees and some dodgy fees. David Walsh has spoken to one of the owners. Andrea Radzianzi, the Leeds owner, and Mark Watson are the two men involved. Mark Watson was at BT for a while. And I mean, they're in 11 countries, soon to be more. They're launching in Portugal this week. Watson says they have 15 million paying subscribers. I mean, look, the coverage is terrible, and this is dreadful for golf because no one is watching this thing. Ironically, you can watch it for free because you get a week's trial, but no one's going to the trouble. Yeah. He says, though, the wider point about TV and money, his argument is, if you look at what Sky ultimately do, he says their role is an aggregator of content. So they go out, they get everything, they buy it up, and they package it, and then they turn around to you and say, look, we've done all the work for you, 70 quid a month, hand it over, and you get everything. But he does make the very fair argument. Are they maintaining the value of their offering? To do that, they've got to keep all the content. And if things like La Liga and European rugby are lost, does it reach a point where consumers have had enough? And, I mean, we may be reaching that point. And he does talk interestingly about the music industry, where I think we're at that point now with sport, aren't we? He says, music industry going along lovely, and then piracy almost destroys the business. And in the end, it's saved by Spotify and Apple Music to a point where he says that young people will pay when it's affordable and a good product. He says that is where sport has to go.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. Most people I know are watching stuff illegally.
Yeah.
And maybe we come back to a point where, okay, you think, well, like the streams are a bit dodgy at times, or you want to be able to record stuff and that's not always possible. Yeah. So do you know what? €15 a month, €10 a month, I'll pay that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's we're at the cusp of something in sport, and I don't actually know where it's going to go.
I think that is definitely the case. And like that's why I find this really interesting, bringing up the Spotify model.
That's the one, isn't it?
Yeah, because like I find this now, like I work from home, you work from home, Mick, as well. And like if you have a break for a coffee or something, you're flicking through the channels, and I only subscribe to Sky Sports, I don't bother with BT, etc. Because when you subscribe to Netflix and I subscribe to Amazon Prime, I'm like, you can't watch everything. You have to pick and choose.
Yeah.
But I find like Sky has too many sports channels now. It's very clear to me. Like you flick around and you'll see they're repeating a League One playoff final or Premier League years from 97, 98. You're thinking, who's watching that? Like it's just filler. A lot of it is filler. So the model is, like I remember when I signed up to Spotify, at the start it took the free thing with the ads.
Yeah.
And then I'd for a few weeks, I thought, oh, it's only a few quid. I'll just do it with no ads.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way with sport. If you make it, like, I don't even know what Spotify is now, probably 10 euro a month or something. It's very reasonable.
Yeah.
But if you make sport that affordable, I think it will kill the illegal streams. You know, that is the way forward.
I also think there's an aspect of, I mean, one of the things that would be very attractive in terms of Spotify to younger listeners, we'd say as well, is the fact that you can tailor your music. Like, you don't have to have the whole album. And I think that transfers over to sport here as well. Like, Sky Sports is quite an old model in its own way. It's a TV channel.
1992 now is the...
Yeah.
And I mean, the model was around before that as well.
Yeah.
So but just
the idea that you have TV listings, then that's what you get. So as opposed to being able to pick and choose the bits you want.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, that's where it's going, I would have thought. You know, I mean, how they actually make that work with all the various different sporting bodies and all their various different vested interests, I don't know. But that's probably where it's going.
But it's an interesting one. I find it interesting even the last week, how much, or the last 10 days, whatever it was, how many hours RT committed to the European Championships.
Yeah.
Like they committed to, they gave it Olympic style coverage. It was 15, 16 hours a day, close on, I would think. And then you see like with TV3, you know, you obviously have involved Joe, like they're going to have more or less an exclusive sports channel now, aren't they?
Yeah, Virgin Sports.
Yeah, yeah. So it is a period of great flux and change, like, and how it all pans out to be fascinating.
But it's interesting to have just that little confluence of those three sports, like golf, athletics, boxing. Like, as you said, like boxing on terrestrial TV was a dream, you know? Even athletics on terrestrial television.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember they used to have like, you know, racing from Zurich and all those Diamond League.
The equivalent of Grand Prix meetings, the equivalent of Diamond League now.
On Wednesday night, live, you know, and it was fab, you know? I mean, it really got an audience, you know? Of course, it was a time when there was very little sport on television relative to now, but still it was putting it out there in front of people. Yeah. Golf, the same. So the more you go back behind these, especially for sports like that, and especially, I suppose, from a media point of view, at a time when the big beasts are taking all the space, like, it's very easy to ignore athletics. If you want to, it's fairly easy to downgrade the golf if you want to.
Well, Shane Lowry's tied for fourth or fifth. He's level with Tiger Woods and 8 under, and he's gone into a Sunday at a major, and it's nowhere.
Yeah, well, you know what part of that is, well, Joe? I think the GA calendar is part of it.
Sure.
I think the GA calendar is messy because it's been too busy. There's just too much on every week, of a massive scale. Like going from last week's Super 8s, final week of Super 8s, plus a hurling semi-final replay, two football semi-finals this week, hurling final next week. And then that's coinciding with the start of the Premier League.
Yeah.
So even something as big as the USPGA is getting squeezed.
Yeah.
And particularly with you have this European Championship on as well, which has become, which wasn't there before as a combined event. So
is there one potential issue for sport and sports broadcasting, though, in that Spotify have everything? So it's a lovely catch-all. You give your tenner a month, you get everything. In sport, like, so much of the value is the exclusivity. Like, the reason 11 Sports have paid the USPGA $7.5 million is because that's the only place you can get it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I think the real issue, what's bugging people now is suddenly they used to have everything on Sky and now it's become fractured. And
the other thing, if you go down the Spotify model, sorry, I'll just finish
the point. So everything suddenly is fractured. So maybe some people then paid for BT as well as their Sky. And now 11 Sports come along or something else come along, and you're like, well, I'm not paying for that as well.
That's the point. Yeah.
But so will we ever, like, companies like 11 Sports are going to insist on exclusivity. So I do wonder, we're not going to reach a point, a Spotify-type sport thing, where you pay 15 a month and get all the sport, because I think sport's going to stay fractured. I think certain channels will.
I think you'll get a soccer package or a rugby package or whatever.
Yeah.
And it will become, there won't be as many general sports fans, I think, because people won't fork out for four or five different subscriptions.
But how would that work in a Sky and BT world? Because BT will say, well, we want these games. If you want the half five games on a Saturday, you're coming to us. And Sky will say, well, we've got all the other games.
Yeah. But the Sky BT world might be disappearing, though.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Or it might be changing dramatically. Like, the other thing is important. A lot of musicians, well, virtually all musicians, despise the Spotify model.
They're getting nothing.
Get patents out of it. Right. So if sport goes down that route, they mightn't be getting anything. If they want accessibility and the numbers in terms of audience, they mightn't be getting anything like the money they've got from Sky BT over the years. So.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we'll see how it all pans out. Some other bits and pieces. By the way, yeah, Shane Lowry's doing very well. Tiger Woods is doing well. Brooks Koepka is the leader. We'll probably touch on it on tomorrow's show or certainly Tuesday. Kieran McGeehan's running this evening. Podcasters will have seen this race.
Okay.
So, you know.
So I just want to talk on a general point of view about the European Championships. It's and with the same with the Worlds last year in London, I really... because there are so many reasons to question athletics. We know that over the years of stuff that's happened. But it's brilliant to get a reminder of what amazing sport can be. Like the crowds make it as well. Like London got the Olympic Stadium was packed last year. 60,000 in the stadium in Berlin last night. And you do see, I do think, watching Thomas Barr the other night, there's still very few things in sport as thrilling as watching an Irish person win a major medal in track and field. Like, because it's sport at its most, not primitive level, but the simple, like running faster than somebody. You can't get much simpler than that.
You don't need to explain the rules.
No. But it's just, there's just a buzz from it. And particularly Thomas, I'm sure you've dealt with him, like most people have interviewed Thomas this stage. But Athletics Ireland should be giving him 100 grand a year to go into schools. Kids would love him. Mm. He has this incredibly infectious personality. He just gets on with everybody. And Kira McGeehan is somebody he had a lot of time for. And she made a massive move, leaving Gerry Kieran had moved to Manchester. And she said a rough time in major championships the last few years, but she looked really good in her semi-final. This is a podcast, don't know how the final went, but she looks in good form.
Well, I think in the final, only three that she will... So Carl Dennehy makes the point.
Yeah.
Only three that she'll look across at on the starting blocks have run faster than her this year.
Yeah, she'll be giving herself a real chance, and she has a real chance.
She won bronze in the Europeans a couple of years ago,
and then
has had just terrible luck at major championships.
Yeah.
And people like, I mean, her pedigree at underage level, I mean, we've got star here if she could capitalise on it.
But like, Eamon Sweeney, just in a broader point, like to tie in with the athletics thing and the European championships being on TV, this Irish sport across the board has never been stronger. Like, there's been medals delivered in the last few weeks, everything from triathlon, rowing, athletics, cycling. We saw what the hockey woman did getting the World Cup final. You know how good the rugby team are. Mm-hmm. Horse racing just cleans up all the time. Like, the soccer is the one you're looking at the moment that's not doing what we'd like it to. But across the board, for years we were always dependent on a couple of sports for medals. Now, even boxing, Eamon lists it off there. The amount of boxing medals at underage now is just, they're cleaning up.
Even the week that's in it, like, I mean, you know, there's two Irish boxers fighting for world titles and Frampton up wins.
There's hardly a word on Paddy Power's fighting for world title, one of the major figures in Irish boxing in the last 20 years, and we know why that is, which is very sad now. Mm.
But like the athletics thing, I mean, I've always thought that there's a sort of... like a muscle memory in the Irish nation for athletics, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, going right back, it's just in us.
Yeah, like the Martin Games and Herb Elliott, wasn't it, set the world record. That 60th anniversary was last week.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen the crowd? There's over 20,000 at Santry for it. In the 50s, like it was
like
amazing.
Ronnie Delaney used to fill, like, used to go to see Ronnie Delaney running in Lansdowne Road, like. You know, he used to set up a track for him and he'd run and
Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, you even go back to the field eventually with Pat Callan and all those guys, Bob Tisdall and the hurdles. Yeah. Like, it's just there. We were talking about, I mean, even your own, even in our own kind of lifetimes are just about, like, we'll say, John Tracy.
Yeah, yeah.
All that stuff. It's all there. And, you know, again, it was nice, like, to be able to flick on the TV and there's some athletics.
Yeah, you know.
Without having to go digging for it, you know. It's great. And, I mean, it's what those sports need to be about is keeping it terrestrial, I think,
or keeping it
at least in whatever format, getting themselves out to the largest possible audience without completely selling themselves short. But really, they need to be out there because there is an opportunity for all of these sports, you know?
Yeah, I think as a child, I didn't really appreciate that Sonia O'Sullivan was quite special. I was a bit spoiled at the time. I was like, all right, yeah, great.
But again, if you think about it, I mean, we're coming off an era there with all the guys in America as well. So, I mean, Sonia was exceptional, but she was the most exceptional of an exceptional generation.
Absolutely.
You know,
because the greatest night of Irish sport I've ever been at, genuinely was.
Okay, hang on.
What was it?
Katie Taylor.
No. The most enjoyable was Sonia. I was there for when Sonia O'Sullivan won her silver in Sydney.
That was your
But
best.
Just everything that happened, like Michael Johnson won 400 meter in his final gold in his final ever race. Gabriel Selassie won the 10,000 meters in the final stride of an incredible race from Paul Tergat of Kenya.
Yeah.
So there was all different. Like Kathy Freeman, I don't remember her at 400 meters because it was amazing because the pressure on her being an Aboriginal athlete and there was so much made of in Australia winning the 400 meters. But what struck me the other night watching the athletics was Jakob Ingebrigtsen of Norway won the 1500 meters title, right, at 17. Mm. He was born 6 days before Sonia's silver in Sydney. So that made me feel very old.
Yeah.
But he's the third.
Well, we are very old. But
that's more about us than them, no?
Both his brothers have won it as well. The European Championship won the 1500 in the last 2 years. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing
They're an
story,
amazing family, yeah.
Right, wow. Okay, well, we wish Kieran McGeehan well this evening. Desindo, just for the Liverpool fan here. Are there two Liverpool fans here? There's one anyway. Okay, for your sins, Mick Foley. This is just the kind of thing.
As well, then.
This is just the kind
it's
of thing.
It's not a confession.
Well.
There's
a pretense of being neutral.
Liverpool have just. Obviously, Liverpool have spent the most in the transfer window. And as a use of space, this is just about 6 inches on the top right of page 9. And they've gone through all Liverpool's managers since their last title win, who they've bought and who they've sold. And so they've done it in different categories. 10 most expensive, the big five who left, good value, and then at the end, money for nothing. And do you know what? It's brilliant. It's
yeah,
the kind
it
of
is.
15 minutes looking at and it brings back memories.
It brings back 25 years of sort of just how is he there? Where did they find him? It's the ultimate wall of shame, you know?
Yeah.
The lads were here.
I got into a kind of a circle of, I don't know what you call circle of shame with Paul Howard and a few others on Twitter during the week about putting in bids for Liverpool players, and somebody was saying they have, you know, you could put in a bid for them. Somebody was saying, you know, I put in a bid for Sean Dundee a few years ago. You know, he helps around the house. I was saying, I put in a bid three packets of hula hoops in yesterday's Herald for Alberto Moreno.
Yeah. Did you have a line about István Kozma?
István Kozma, yeah, he's on a plaque outside the. I was at a friendly in the stadium in Budapest, Ireland friendly. And they have a plaque outside of Hungary Greats, and István Kozma's on it. But what jumps out at me...
We've Kenny Dalglish, then Souness, then Roy Evans, then Houllier, then Benitez, then Hodgson, then Kenny Dalglish again, then Rodgers, then Klopp. Who's coming out of this best?
Klopp, that's what
Klopp.
Think. Like, it jumps out, Klopp has
so
signed very few flops.
Yeah.
You know, that's a bit of a rant. But, no, whether it's him or a transfer committee or whatever, they tend to pay off. And also, it's very interesting, he's offloaded, I think, 24 players in the last 2 years. He's got rid of a hell of a lot of duds as well.
You could argue, in terms of the value aspect of it, right? Dalglish back in the 80s, it's such a different era now, but some of the guys he bought that time in the late 80s were exceptional. Like, I mean, he got Peter Beardsley, John Barnes, he got Aldridge, he brought Rush back.
Yeah.
Houghton.
Staunton for £20,000.
Yeah.
Staunton
but it's funny,
grand, but
that's
that
when you realised that he was starting to slip, is when he bought the likes of Jimmy Carter
and
David Speedy. I think that's when you knew something's up with him because he lost his touch a little
bit. But I remember as a kid, like when they bought John Barnes for £900,000, that was gigantic money. Like, I mean, this was Liverpool spending money like they had never spent before back that time. Because they had always brought Les True and got like Alan Hansen for, you know, a set of tracksuits or whatever from some place up in Scotland, that kind of thing. Whereas like these, are, I mean, he paid $1 million for Ronnie Rosenthal.
Yeah. Like Robbie Keane to Liverpool was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It was $19 million, wasn't it?
Yeah, Dan had a piece on it yesterday and I couldn't believe it was that long ago, but I think the tone of Dan's piece was like, that was the last big Irish transfer, really. Like,
yeah.
It's a long time ago now.
Gerard Houllier's money for nothing section. Cisse, 14 million. Juff, 10 million. Kirkland, 6 million. Ziga, 5 million. Biscan, 5 million. Jau, 4.7. Vesterville, 4 million. The next Zidane, that's Giroud, 3.7 million.
Oh, you'd have to laugh, wouldn't you, Joe?
And then Benitez went for Penin, 6.7 million. Morientes, 6.3. Agger, 5.8. Sissoko, 5.6.
But the great story about Penin was, remember he bought a Porsche or a Ferrari and he forgot he owned it? He left it parked outside the train station for 2 years.
That's right.
In terms of good value, like Kenny, so like Kenny Dalglish second time around, money for nothing reads badly. Carroll, 35 million. Downing, 20 million. Charlie Adams, 7.5 million. Coates, 8 million. Yeah. In fairness, for his good value, Suarez for 22 million, and Henderson 16 million, and Bellamy for free.
Yeah, that's excellent. Well. Yeah, absolutely.
I think you could say Suarez that time. I'd say, again, going back to Dalglish's first term round, I'd say this is the first time since that time, the early, like late '80s, early '90s, that Liverpool are paying top dollar for top players. Do you know what I mean?
I totally agree. What they've done this year, from the Van Dijk signing, is said, we need someone there. Let's just pay a load of money for one person to fill the gap. Mm-hmm. Like Van Gaal and Brendan Rodgers here doesn't age brilliantly. Van Gaal and Rodgers, just like, and our Spurs with the Bale money. Yeah. Just buy like 15 players, all of the same, not going to propel you forward kind of level.
And that's what Liverpool did with the Suarez money. Oh, listen, that's how they ended up with...
give us Brendan Rodgers there, because Brendan Rodgers doesn't age great here.
No. Yeah. Well, I guess top 10 are Benteke, Firmino's worked out well. Lallana's okay. Lovren, Markovic, no. Balotelli, no. Joe Allen was all right. Sacco, no. Klein, not really sure yet. And
Sturridge's
been okay.
To be fair, on his good value list, he did buy Coutinho for 8.6 million.
Yeah, that was a snip.
That's your big one.
You have those. You kind of have those. You know, like Xabi Alonso. You know, they've used to pick up lads like that here and there all the way through. They're sprinkled all through. Million. That's the thing about Liverpool this time around. I think it's the best Liverpool starting 11 they've had in 25 years.
Do you think this could be the year?
I'm not going there, Joe. I'm not going there.
They've 25 points to bridge on City as the problem.
They have a very handy start to the season. So they should, if they don't get out of the blocks running, as a Liverpool supporter, I'd be worried. But I think it's the best starting 11 they've had in 30 years, actually. And I would say that the squad still is probably maybe three players short, four players short. Just utility guys. Arbeloas, I call them.
Yes.
Need a few Arbeloas.
You do. Some Jimmy Traore's in there.
Let's say Arbeloas.
You win a Champions League with Jimmy Traore, you know?
Yeah. You're going places if you do
that.
Yeah.
More than anything, it's just the general mood music around Klopp and Liverpool, which is so appealing. Like, the Man United fans in the room are like, oh my gosh, we're stuck.
And there's interesting stuff about the club. Simon Hughes in the London Independent, a piece about just about their involvement in the community, because they were...
Oof, bad story for a while around the stadium.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's what I'm about to say. Yeah. They were getting rightly criticised for a lot of the ways they operated, but they have made a big effort to just reconnect and go back to the kind of ideas that Shankly had, which is very
Klopp,
difficult in this kind of...
You put that down to Klopp?
I would put down it partly to him.
I think it's a lot of things. I think didn't they get Tony Barrett in there as a kind of a fan liaison?
That helps big time.
That was massive.
And the
they
owners.
Also had a major issue around the fact that they had bought up all that area on Anfield. I mean, the club destroyed that area.
Yeah, deliberately. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Deliberately destroyed it, willfully, and it was absolutely appalling what they did. And I think they're trying to roll back on that now a little bit. But the Klopp thing is great and all, but at the risk of sort of channeling someone like a Kerry football fan, it's not about vibes anymore. You know?
Yeah.
Deliver.
Yeah.
Full stop.
What would be a deliverance this year?
What would be a deliverance? Well, I mean, there's only one thing left to win.
Yeah.
That's it. And I mean, it's not that you're saying they have to win it, but I mean, I would be old school that way. Like, I mean, getting to the Champions League final and all that stuff is great. And even when they won it in Istanbul, obviously, was wonderful. But I'm old school. I always prefer to win the league first and then you move forward after that. So,
I still think they're far better place to win the Champions League. I think that they're suited to knockout football. I don't think they'll win the league. I think City will...
Get there.
They'll slip. They mightn't get quite as many points, but they'll go very close to it. They haven't invested heavily, but Mendy is like a new signing, and you know
they've just picked up Mahrez.
Yeah, and they've been
Mahrez. Played 20 games this year.
You know, they've another pre-season under Guardiola, and they're an awesome team.
The only thing that'll catch them in the Premier League now is boredom. Yeah. You know, and if they just put all their eggs in the Champions League basket, as it were. But you're right; they'll probably get caught now in a couple of silly places on the road and start to get themselves into. And there'll be crisis talk and all the rest of it, but they're just such a good squad. And they seem to have a great attitude and the whole environment that he's created around it. Even though it's probably it always strikes me that it's kind of, you know, we're all in it together kind of thing. It's a bit fake. Yeah. In professional football, but he seems but to have
think,
worked. He
yeah,
seems
but I think vibes do matter. You know?
Oh, they do matter.
Because
yeah,
even like the mood music from the two Manchester clubs when they were in America, like Mourinho was just saying, I have nobody. Look at the players I have. Yeah. And Guardiola was saying the exact opposite. I have a load of young players out here. They've been brilliant for me, really impressed with their attitude, blah, blah, blah. He might never play any of them again, but at least he's putting out positive vibes.
Saying that stuff helps.
That kind of matters. Yeah. I'd like to see the likes of Phil Foden, who they all talk up so much. Like, see what he's like, give him a run. Because why do they invest so much in these academies and never throw anybody in? Like, that's what one of the positives of Liverpool last year, that Alexander-Arnold was stuck in the team and ended up in a Champions League final. And what's the guy's name? Is it Curtis Jones that they were raving about in pre-season? He's only 17, but you'd love to see somebody like that get a chance. It's not all about money.
Yeah,
big
but then Ben Woodburn's gone out on loan, isn't he, somewhere? Yeah. He's gone somewhere, so kind of swings and roundabouts.
Sometimes you do see City Champions League matches and it's not even a full house, and you think if there were some local lads in there who'd come through, there just might be a bit more, this is ours.
Connection.
Yeah. You know, this actually is still our club as opposed to... Yeah, whatever it is now.
Yeah, something I can't get my head around is the crowds at pre-season games often. Like the amount of money people spend to follow the club. Like
in England or...?
England. I was walking around town before the Arsenal-Chelsea game and there was a load of Arsenal-Chelsea fans had come over from London for it.
Oh, really?
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
The amount of money they must spend all year round is just incredible.
Yeah. We'll leave it there unless there's anything else we should point people in the direction of.
Yeah, I think that's about it.
All the bases, okay.
Brilliant stuff. So Mick Foley from the Sunday Times, off to Croke Park now. Thanks a million for coming.
Straight there, thanks very much.
Kieran Cunningham from the Irish Daily Star. Thanks as ever, Kieran.
No problem.
We'll say goodbye to you on Facebook Live and we'll see you again next week.
Off the Ball on News Talk.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.